Ashes spilled on the Hayes' expensive bedside tables and sitting area tables, maps of Washington and New York lying open on the floor atop discarded socks and shoes, a messy young boy intent upon outraging his parents with his slovenliness could hardly have done worse. But there, hung over the back of a chair not 3 feet inside the room, was the jacket that Holmes had been wearing yesterday morning when he'd spoken to Hay, King, and James in Hayes' study. Glancing guiltily over his shoulder, seeing no one, but realizing that he would have only a few seconds in which to spy and pry, James stepped quickly into the room and felt in the inside breast pocket of that jacket. Holmes had taken out 4 photographs at the beginning of his talk and eventually shown them 3 of them. Colonel Sebastian Moran, the blurred image of young Lucan Adler, and an old photograph of the woman he said was Irene Adler, before she pretended to be Clover Adams's friend, Rebecca Lorne. The 4th photograph, he'd never shown them. James did not expect to find anything, so he was surprised when he pulled out the small pack of 4 photos and a telegram flimsy. 3 of the images were indeed the ones shared with the other men on Monday, but the 4th photograph, quite formal, the man wearing a long-tailed black suit and old-fashioned high collars, the single image obviously snipped with scissors from a larger photograph, was of a man in his 40s or 50s, clean-shaven and strangely hollow-cheeked, his penetrating gaze peering out from under a commanding and balding at the top brow. A few loose strands of both dark and graying hair hung down over the man's oddly lupine ears. There was something professorial in the man's dress and slightly hunched manner, but also something predatory in the way the sharp-featured face protruded forward with the black shoulders rising behind it. As formal as the man's pose was, James thought he could see a strange glimpse of the man's tongue caught in the act of flicking out over just visible, small, disturbingly sharp teeth. The telegram was addressed to Sherlock Holmes to be picked up in a nearby Washington Western Union office, had the previous day's date on it, and was brief. Confirmed that Moriarty has advanced networks working in France, Germany, Italy, and Greece. Stop. Also networks funding and supporting criminals and anarchists in Washington, New York, Baltimore, and Chicago. Stop. Proceed with caution. Stop. Mycroft. James set the 4 photos and folded telegram back in the jacket pocket and hurried out into the hall just as one of the maids carrying fresh linens turned the corner. She stepped aside to let James pass toward his own room, and the author detected no recognition of his quick trespass in her properly downturned eyes. James crossed the small park and walked east on Pennsylvania Avenue, occasionally glancing without much interest through the iron fence across the north lawn of the White House at the executive mansion itself. At the corner, he turned south on 15th Street Northwest and walked a little more than 4 blocks that way before he turned southeast on a more southerly extension of Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest. After a brisk mile on Pennsylvania Avenue, James had to wait a moment before he could cross between carriages and heavy horse-drawn carts to follow Constitution Avenue a little more than a half mile due east. He decided to get a glimpse of the new Thomas Jefferson building, if only to tell Hay later that he had. 3 blocks walking south on 2nd Street brought him to the construction site. 3 stories of the imposing new home for the library had risen, but the shell was still hollow and the facades festooned with cranes, ropes, nautical-looking arrangements of block and tackle, and wood and iron lattices making rigid the empty areas between the high pillars up on that 3rd-story level. The entire city block surrounding the rising structure was littered with numbered blocks of granite, pallets of lumber protected from the weather with rubber canvas wrappings, loaded carts, workmen, and even more cranes, pulleys, and cables. James could have continued walking south and then back to the Capitol via Independence Avenue, but he chose to turn around, retrace his steps to East Capitol Street, and pass through a muddy expanse of nothingness which might have been unkempt gardens, making sure to stay on the narrow paved path, before climbing the stairs to the east entrance of the nation's capital. That morning, when James and Hay had been overheard by Clara, the author expected either a row or for his friend John to lie, but neither occurred. Hay confessed everything to his wife. Instead of being outraged at being misled, Clara Hay had been delighted that their guest, Jan Sigerson, was actually the detective Sherlock Holmes in disguise. James guessed that Hay had revealed all this to his wife because he was uncertain about when Holmes himself might appear before Clara and the servants, sans the Sigerson disguise. "Oh, he's a master of disguise," Clara had gushed, clapping her hands together as if in prayer. "What an honor to have the world's first and foremost consulting detective as a guest here in our home. I cannot wait to tell Marie and Ellen and—"
"You must tell no one, my dear," interrupted Hay, holding one finger up in stern admonition. "Mr. Holmes is here in disguise on what I take to be a very serious mission indeed, and one in which his life may be in danger if the news of his presence in America were to become known. This is a good part of the reason that Harry has asked us to keep his visit with Holmes confidential as well."
"Oh, yes, of course. I understand, but after the adventure is over," said Clara Hay, her steepled fingers moving to her lips as if sealing them for the time being. She was still smiling broadly. "I must bring down the January issue of Harper's Weekly, with the shocking story, The Cardboard Box, in it. Oh, and the February Harper's with The Yellow Face Tale in it. We must ask Mr. Holmes's opinion on Dr. Watson's chronicling of these adventures."
Hay took his wife's hands in his own. "Clara, darling, we must not make our guest feel self-conscious. Mr. Holmes is not the author of these published adventures, you must remember. There might be elements of exaggeration or other possibly embarrassing parts to the tales that Mr. Holmes may feel uncomfortable about."
Of course," said Clara.
But she was still smiling, and James was sure, as he hurried upstairs to fetch his umbrella so he could leave before Holmes awoke, that the copies of Harper's Weekly would make their way downstairs and into Holmes's sphere of attention before the day was out. When James had told Hay that "I might drop in at the Library of Congress to browse a bit," Hay had insisted on writing a little note of introduction. James hadn't thought that a note of introduction would be needed to use what he understood was a public library, but he tucked the note in his jacket pocket and not thought about it until stopped by some minor librarians just inside the door of the cluttered library part of the Capitol building. Naturally, Hay being Hay, the note of introduction was to the Librarian of Congress, a certain Ainsworth Rand Spofford. The lowly librarians at the entrance desk had leaped out of their seats upon reading the note from Hay, fluttered like startled pigeons, and then the chief amongst these lowly workers personally led Henry James up two flights of stairs to the Librarian of Congress's office. Spofford himself was a thin, sickly-looking old fellow with a scraggly gray beard and long, lank hair that fell away from a part that was more bald pate than part. His face was dominated by a nose that James thought might be up to chiseling stone over at the library's new site. The librarian came around his huge desk to shake James by the hand, although it was more a limp offering of a dead, white, boneless thing than a handshake.
"Welcome, Mr. James. Welcome indeed. The Library of Congress is honored to have you visit us. How can we be of service today?"
James was, for the instant, a bit nonplussed. He'd imagined his research here as being anonymous, invisible.
"Looking in on our collection of your own wonderful novels and collections, perhaps?"
prompted Ainsworth Rand Spofford. He was still standing next to James and seemed to be feeling out of his element when not sitting behind his huge desk.
"Oh, gracious, no, no," demurred James. "Just a few minutes of research, one might generously call it."
"Of course,"
cried Spofford,
rubbing his bony hands together as if the two men had just consummated a major business deal. The librarian touched an elaborate gadget on his desk, and a second later, a hidden door in a wall of books to one side opened, and a tall, thin lady entered silently.
"This is Miss Miller, my chief librarian assistant," said Spofford. "Our honored guest today, Miss Miller, the famous American writer Henry James."
Since Miss Miller had stopped 3 yards away, too far for even an American gender egalitarian handshake, the famous American writer Henry James bowed slightly. Miss Miller, James saw, was a newspaper cartoonist's caricature of a librarian. Tall, thin to the point of visible boniness, hair done up in an unattractive bun, dressed in an ugly brown cotton shift with what looked to be a man's shirt buttoned beneath it. Tiny Benjamin Franklin bifocals perched on the end of her long nose, and with a name tag on the slight bump of what could be her left breast under the burlap-looking fabric of her shift. D. Miller.
D. Miller, thought James. Please, God, no.
"Miss Miller's first name is Daisy, so the two of you should be well acquainted,"
said librarian Ainsworth Rand Spofford with a graveled bark that must have been some form of laughter. Miss Miller blushed mightily. James looked down at his shoes, which had picked up some unsightly dust during his walk from the construction site.
"Mr. James would like to conduct some research, Miss Miller," Spofford was saying. "If you need any additional help, Mr. James, please call upon me at once."
And the limp hand was offered again. James touched the relic and followed Miss Miller out through the door in the bookcase. The mere librarian, no capital L with her, led him through a warren of book-cluttered small offices and then out into a narrow, 3-story-high corridor, which James, with a sense of shock, realized was the Library of Congress itself, or part of it. Books not only filled every available shelf, but were stacked on the main floor, behind the iron railings on each mezzanine, and on each available table, desk, and surface. Miss Miller caught his shocked gaze.
"When Librarian Spofford assumed his post in 1864, appointed by President Lincoln himself," she said in a surprisingly sensual voice, "the Library of Congress had fewer than 60,000 volumes, much of the collection based upon Thomas Jefferson's original gift of his private library. Now we have almost 400,000, passing the Boston Public Library as the richest library source in America. And Librarian Spofford fully intends for the library to have 1 million volumes by the time we move to the new Thomas Jefferson building in 3 years.
Commendable, James heard himself murmur as they moved down the crowded corridor, dodging piles of books.
Most commendable. Wonderful.
They paused at a junction of corridors, more heaps of books visible everywhere below the narrow, vaulted corridor ceiling 3 stories above.
How may I help you, Mr. James?
I was thinking,
stammered the famous author.
That is, I wondered if you might have a copy of a rather obscure book of physics or mathematics titled The Dynamics of an Asteroid?
Miss Miller laughed softly, and her laugh was as pleasant and melodious as her superiors had been grating.
Professor Moriarty's book. Of course we have it. Though you are right, Mr. James, it is very rare. But Librarian Spofford has continued the library's original goal of advancing its collection of science and mathematical references.
James put both hands on his umbrella handle and nodded, trying to hide how startled he'd been by her quick recognition of the volume's author.
It's good you asked for assistance, sir, said Miss Miller, for we've had to put the dynamics of an asteroid on a restricted viewing basis.
Really? For such an obscure and technical title? Why is that, Miss Miller?
Why, after the Reuters news agency story 2 years ago, as well as the story the New York Times reprinted from the London Times, of Professor James Moriarty's disappearance at Reichenbach Falls with the English detective Sherlock Holmes. We've had far too many requests by common visitors to the library to see this valuable book. We were afraid that without supervision, someone would pilfer it for novelty value, if nothing else. Ah, said James. This way, Mr. James.
Miss Miller led him toward a staircase with only a narrow aisle on the iron steps between more unruly stacks of books. The next 2 hours were an odd education for Henry James. He would never have found Professor James Moriarty's works or any references to him had he been left to his own devices, as he'd planned so furtively to be. But Miss Miller tracked down everything the United States Library of Congress had on the now famous or infamous professor. The first two books she brought him were the much-mentioned The Dynamics of an Asteroid, 209 pages of impenetrable equations with very few words, just as advertised, and then a thinner book, the 68-page A Treatise on the Binomial Theorem. The latter had been published way back in 1871, the same year, according to a brief note in the back, that James Nolan Moriarty received his twin degrees in mathematics and applied physics from University College, Dublin. The book had been released by a small Dublin publishing house, which James had never heard of, and was dedicated to Carl Gottfried Neumann, a professor at the University of Leipzig. James had never heard of Professor Neumann, but Miss Miller assured him that he was an important figure, mentioned frequently in German and other foreign journals of mathematics, das Dirichlet'sche Prinzip in seiner Anwendung auf die Riemannschen Flächen, to prove it. James might have paused to wonder why a student at Trinity College in Dublin was so advanced that he dedicated his first book of mathematical theory to a professor in Leipzig, but instead he explained to Miss Miller that he was primarily interested in biographical information about Professor Moriarty, and any photographs of the professor, if those were handy. He could see the curiosity in her eyes, but Miss Miller was far too much the professional to inquire, "Are you thinking of writing a book about the man who killed Sherlock Holmes?" She hurried off to find more references in various science sections of the maze of stacks, shelves, and locked rooms that was the Library of Congress. In less than an hour, James had every reference the library had on the man Sherlock Holmes in print had called the Napoleon of Crime and, in person, had insisted was a figment of his imagination. Even dates and places of birth did not agree. One who's who in European mathematics from 1884 stated that Professor James Moriarty, no middle name given, author of the treatise on the binomial theorem, had been born in Dublin in 1846. In a reference book for the University College, Dublin, which showed a Professor James N. Moriarty as being a professor of mathematics there from 1872 until 1878, gave the man's year of birth as 1849, and the place of birth as Greystones, which Miss Miller helped James look up in an atlas of Ireland, and which turned out to be a very small village between Dublin and Wicklow. So if Moriarty were alive today, if he hadn't died in 1891 at Reichenbach Falls, how old would he be? 47 or 44? The next shock for James was when he found the copyright date of The Dynamics of an Asteroid, published by an imprint he'd never heard of in London, 1890. Even if Moriarty had been born at the later date given, he would have been 41 years old in the year the book was published. Old, from the little that Henry James understood, for a mathematician's first major publication. Some don at Oxford had once told James in passing that mathematicians such as Charles Dodgson, known to the world as Lewis Carroll, usually published their best work when they were younger than 30. Thumbing through the literal hieroglyphics, to James, of the mathematical equations of The Dynamics of an Asteroid, he found himself muttering aloud, "If I only had the vaguest idea of what this volume is about."
"I've heard some of the visiting scientists discuss it," said Miss Miller, thinking that he had addressed her with the question. "It seems that the asteroid in question creates what is known to astronomers and mathematicians as a three-body problem. Take any two celestial bodies and their gravitational attraction, tidal effect on the other, tumbling, three-dimensional orientations, and so forth can be plotted with both modern and classical mathematical techniques. But add a third body, evidently then the tumbling, orientation, and even trajectory of an asteroid becomes all but incalculable. Professor James Moriarty's great renown in this book came, if I understand the scientists and mathematicians correctly, from pointing out what cannot be calculated.
Very interesting, said James, although her summary of others' analysis was useless to him. After a moment, he spoke again.
So it appears that there is no chance of finding a photograph of Professor Moriarty. Please come with me, Mr. James.
Miss Miller, James tried not to think of her unfortunate first name, marched ahead of him with elbows pumping, a soldier going off to war. They had to climb into what had to be the dusty attic of the Capitol, although not under the great dome, as far as James could tell, and Miss Miller had to unlock three more doors before they came to a room filled with thousands of carefully filed journals.
Mathematics, European conferences,
muttered Miss Miller to herself, gesturing behind her back for James to take the only seat available in the room, a low chair at what seemed to be a student's desk in the center of the impossibly cluttered room. James was certain that he would have nightmares about this library for years to come.
Here,
she cried at last, and brought a German journal with a title too long and umlauted and fraktured for James to bother trying to decipher. She opened to page 36 and stabbed her finger down at a line of eight middle-aged men standing in a line facing the camera. The caption, in German, beneath the photograph said, Conference on Advanced Mathematics and Astronomical Physics, University of Leipzig, July, 1892. The names were listed under each man, but James didn't need to read them. He saw Moriarty at once, on the far right, the same balding head, straggling dark hair, reptilian forward thrusting of his neck, and hint of tongue showing between the thin, pale lips. It was precisely the photograph that he'd illicitly taken from Holmes's jacket and peeked at that very morning. Holmes must have torn it out of a copy of this very journal.
Professor James N. Moriarty, London.
No university affiliation given, but the date of the conference, July 1892, more than a full year after Holmes and the newspaper accounts recorded Moriarty as dying at Reichenbach Falls in May of 1891. Satisfied that he would find out no more about this particular Lazarus at the Library of Congress, James went through the motions of taking a few notes and assured the apologetic Miss Miller that no, despite the apparent paucity of information available, she had been of inestimable help to him. Inestimable. He stood and turned to go then, but could not even find his way through the attic to the stairs. Miss Miller inquired as to which exit from the Capitol he wished to use.
The main front entrance, I believe, said James. Wonderful, said the helpful Miss Miller. You'll get some glimpses of the actual Capitol.
She was his Aeneas down several flights of stairs, around endless stacks of books that would have stopped him in his tracks, through the long, high, cluttered corridors, and then out into the formal marble vaults and under the majestic dome of the United States Capitol building itself. Henry James was impressed not by the colossal Roman size of the structure, but by its almost Grecian white purity, and the early afternoon light shining down onto the marble floors was lovely. Out under the high portico, and with the grand columns framing a view back toward the executive mansion less than a mile away, James turned to the librarian.
Once again, Miss Miller, I must thank you most sincerely for your inestimable help on my little research errand.
He tipped his hat and started to descend, but stopped and turned back when Miss Miller called his name.
Mr. James, I...
She was wringing her hands and blushing.
I may not get another chance, so I hope you will not think it impertinent of me if I take this opportunity to thank you so much for writing what I consider such a lovely and wise novel about a woman's mind.
Daisy Miller? Thought James.
The poor lady has so much to learn about life.
He'd certainly had when he wrote that popular but shallow confection so many years earlier.
Thank you, Miss Miller, he said smoothly, but the eponymous title pales in comparison to its namesake's true beauty and wisdom.
Eponymous,
repeated Miss Daisy Miller, and then blushed an even deeper crimson.
No, Mr. James, I did not mean your novel, Daisy Miller. That was adequate as an entertainment. No, I was referring to your wonderful The Portrait of a Lady.
Ah, so kind,
murmured James through his beard, and tipped his hat again and bowed slightly, and then turned to umbrella tap his way down the wide, white stone steps.
Adequate as an entertainment? Who did this homely prune of a spinster think she was?
It was already mid-afternoon. Not ready to return to the Hayes home, James hunted for a place near the Capitol where he might have a light luncheon. He imagined a bistro or charcuterie, but managed to find only a delicatessen sort of place. Obviously, the kind of establishment attuned to the needs of busy government workers and clerks, with only a brief break time for their luncheons, that served only rude sandwiches and tepid coffee. But it had empty tables outside at this after-luncheon hour, and he was glad to sit in the shade and sip his coffee and think about the import of what he'd seen and learned in the Library of Congress. Until this afternoon, James had been determined to say goodbye to the Hayes, preferably before Henry Adams returned home later in this week, and to return to London on his own. Whatever wave of despair had driven him to Paris and the bank of the Seine at night had passed over, dissipated, and he only wanted to extricate himself from this sticky web of disguises and assumed identities that this Holmes person, whoever he really was, had entangled him in. But now, knowing beyond a doubt that Holmes, by whatever name, had lied to him about inventing Professor James Moriarty, just so that he could die with him at Reichenbach Falls, and after seeing the photograph of the real Moriarty, both from Holmes's jacket pocket and the European journal covering mathematicians and astronomy physicists, James felt a grim new determination to stay with his friends, the Hayes and Henry Adams, until this Sherlock Holmes was completely exposed as the fraud and humbug he was. Reinvigorated by this new resolve, James took the scenic route back to Lafayette Square and John and Clara's front door. Hay, in a state of some excitement, rushed down the stairs to escort him up to the study the minute a servant had let him in.
"He's just now revealing it," Hay said. "He wouldn't until you returned, Harry."
"Reveal," said James. He felt the shadow of dread that came over him every time this Holmes person revealed anything.
Hay's study was a mess. Typewritten cards and envelopes turned out of their boxes and files and strewn everywhere. James was surprised to see Clara there along with her husband and Holmes, not wearing his Sigerson disguise.
"Clara," said James, somewhat bewildered, "you are a part of this?"
"Oh, yes, yes," cried Clara Hay,
the respectable Washington Society matron, while squeezing his hand like a schoolgirl with one hand, while fluttering two copies of Harper's Weekly with her other hand.
"And Mr. Holmes has given me his impressions of both Silver Blaze and the Yellow Face, and..."
"Silence!" shouted John Hay.
The diplomat, renowned for his unflappability, was beside himself with excitement.
"We're just about to hear, for the first time, the results of the typewriter font comparisons."
Sherlock Holmes obviously had the spotlight, and he reveled in it, holding up the original "She Was Murdered" cards, along with various envelopes and typed notes.
"I have the typewriter behind these annual anonymous cards. if not the man, said Holmes, showing the aspects of the typefaces that matched up, beyond any doubt. For heaven's sake, cried John Hay. Who is it, man?
Holmes peered up from examining the font on different notes under a hand lens.
Who, he asked, holding up matching typewritten fonts, is this Samuel Clemens?
Chapter 21. Holmes waited restlessly for the Hay household to go to sleep. He smoked pipe after pipe in his room, cracking the door occasionally to listen. Still, the last shufflings and whispers of the servants continued long after both the Hays and Henry James had gone to their respective bedrooms. Finally, it was silent. Opening wide the window of his room, a window that looked out upon the dark backyard of the large house here at the junction of H Street and 16th Street, Holmes took his heavy shoulder bag of burglary tools and slipped out of the room and down the stairway. He wore a black sweater under a soft black jacket, workman's black trousers, and black shoes with crepe soles Holmes had ordered, made specially for him by Charles F. Stead and Company, a tannery in the north of England. He tiptoed through the kitchen, opened the door without a noise, slipped out, and used one of his breaking and entering tools to lock the door behind him. The Hayes' backyard, mostly garden, faced the Adams' backyard and shared a tall brick wall separating the two. Holmes tossed a rope with a small grapple, tested it, then climbed the wall and dropped to the other side in 10 silent seconds. The garden here was little more than a gesture, and the back of the Adams' property was dominated by a stable designed by the same architect who had done both homes, but an empty stable this night. As Henry James had told him, Henry Hobson Richardson had designed and built both the Adams and Hay House at roughly the same time, but the designs were different. Holmes had spent a long tea with Clara Hay this Tuesday afternoon, showing more than a polite interest in the layout of both grand homes. Now he moved toward the Adams house with the floor plan in his mind. Henry Adams no longer kept a dog. The house was dark save for a few gas pilot lamps burning. The stables were a tall, dark mass behind him. Holmes had made note that all of the first floor windows of the Adams house were covered with wrought iron grills. The kitchen rear door was the best place to enter, and Holmes knew that the easiest way to do that would be to cut a circle of glass from a pane. The iron grill there would be no hindrance to his instrument, but this would leave a sign of his illegal entrance. Holmes placed a soft cloth on the ground outside that door and went to one knee. He could manage the door lock in less than a minute, but the kitchen door had been bolted at two places from the inside before the last servants had left for the night. He would have to dismantle the entire lock, reach in with a rigid piece of wire he could bend to his purposes, pull back those bolts, get in, and then reconstruct the entire lock in its proper place. It would take the better part of an hour, but since he did not plan to leave via this same kitchen door, it would only have to be done once. Holmes glanced at the stars. It was not yet 1 a.m. He had time. Once inside the kitchen, Holmes squatted for several minutes of absolute silence, controlling his breathing so that even he could not hear it, and did nothing but listen to the house. He'd heard both John and Clara Hay mention that Adams's people were off at play for these final 3 days before they would regather and regroup to prepare the house for Henry Adams's return on Friday, and Holmes's instinct told him that the huge house was indeed empty. He lit a hand lamp no larger than his palm and closed the upper and lower louvers so that it cast the dimmest of lights, and that only straight ahead in a narrow beam. In a few minutes, he'd reassembled the entire lock and doorknob apparatus, locked and bolted the back door from the inside again, and was stealing silently up the narrow steps of the servants' rear staircase. Although both houses had been designed in the so-called Romanesque style, Adams's home had a different feeling on the inside and different proportions on the outside. Holmes had noted to James the profusion of towers, turrets, gables, and huge chimneys on the Hayes home. The Adams's abode, dwelt in only by the widower and his staff now, of course, was simpler, more modern-looking from the outside, set off architecturally only by the twin white arches of its entrance. Both homes were four stories tall, but the Adams house had a flat front. One of these rooms on the second floor was Henry Adams's private study, and Holmes found the locked door to it in no time. Next to the study, door also locked, was a room that had been Clover Adams's combination darkroom and small photographic workshop, and which now, according to Clara Hay, had been converted to archives for the dead woman's carefully inventoried photographs. The simple lock took Holmes less than a minute, and then he was in the windowless inner archives room, relighting his louvered hand lamp and looking at the drawer upon drawer of photographic prints and plates. He trusted in Henry Adams's famous neatness and efficiency, and was not disappointed. It had been Adams who had inventoried and archived most of Clover's photographic images after her suicide in December of 1885. It took Holmes only a few minutes to find both the inventory journal, most of it typed out, some still in Henry Adams's neat hand, and then the key to the specially constructed archival file cabinets. Volume 7, page 24, number 50.23, R. Lorne, Feb. 1884. The caption in Clover's tighter script, Rebecca Lorne, standing, in Roman costume. Holmes found and removed the photo and crouched low to prevent any escape of light as he played the beam on his hand lantern over it. The woman's pose was awkward, the Roman costume amateurly made, and her face was turned two-thirds away from the camera. But there was no doubt at all that Rebecca Lorne was the woman Sherlock Holmes had known as Irene Adler. He set this photograph back in place. Volume 7, page 9, number 50.9, R. Lorne. No date given, caption in Clover's hand, Rebecca Lorne with banjo, and also in Clover Adams's hand, very good. Holmes turned the narrow beam on the image. It was a very good photograph of Irene Adler, Rebecca Lorne. The woman was older than Holmes remembered, but Adler was still quite attractive. Clover Adams had posed the woman in the corner of a room near a window, holding her banjo as if she were playing it. Holmes had seen that banjo before. Lorne's, Adler's face was turned toward the window and tilted slightly forward, catching the soft light. Clover had used a wide-angle lens. Holmes guessed it to be the Dallmeyer lens, new to photography about the time Clover died, and had achieved an image poised somewhere between a portrait and capturing an instant of everyday life. Volume 7, page 10, number 50.10. R.H., Feb. 8, 1884, date and the identical caption to the first photo Holmes had seen, also written in Clover's hand, Rebecca Lorne, standing, in Roman costume. Again, the face was turned mostly away from the camera. Holmes set it back. Volume 9, page 17, number 50.106, Old Sweet Springs, Virginia, June 1885, Rebecca Lorne, her cousin, Cliff Richards, H.A., on piazza of house. The writing was all in Henry Adams's careful hand. Holmes removed his small magnifying glass and studied the image. Rebecca Lorne was looking at the camera with only the upper part of her face hidden by her bonnet, but her cousin, Clifton Richards, had lowered his head so that the brim of his hat hid all of his face. The form of the man was athletic enough looking to be Lucan Adler, but one would never be sure. He put the photograph back in its archival setting. Volume 9, page 21, number 50.108, Old Sweet, captions written in Henry Adams's hand, view of house with people on piazza. Again, part of Rebecca Lorne's face was visible, but the man, still Clifton Richards from the clothing and hat, had turned his face full away. Holmes swore under his breath. There was only one more photograph in this series. Volume 9, page 23, number 50.109, Old Sweet Springs, June 1885, Rebecca Lorne and cousin,
all in Henry Adams's careful script, standing in meadow with house in background. Clover had obviously taken this photograph with no warning to her subjects. The two figures stood in high grass that rose almost to their waists. Rebecca Lorne's head and shoulders were a blur as she turned her head to hear something spoken by the man standing next to her and slightly behind her. The man's face, unaware that Clover was taking a photo, was in perfect focus. It was the single finest and clearest image of young Lucan Adler ever captured in a photograph. Holmes' heart was pounding. There were two identical prints in the archival sleeve. Holmes removed one of them, checked with his narrow beam lantern to make sure that the face was as clear as in the top print, and put that photograph in his inner pocket above his heart. He set the other image back in the proper file and closed and locked the long archival drawers. He was just leaving the room when he heard voices downstairs.
"Rousting me out of bed in the middle of the night," a man was saying in an angry voice. "Not his fault the weather turned rough on the Atlantic," another man, an older man, was saying.
"Home 2 days early with no warning,"
groused a third and younger man.
"Have to change the linens in the master bedroom, air everything out, check the towels, and—"
a woman was saying to another woman who kept interrupting with complaints about the late hour.
"The cable didn't say what time in the morning Mr. Adams will be arriving,"
came the older man's deep voice again.
"Let us have everything ready tonight, and have everyone back and ready for inspection at 7 in the morning. I've ordered Martin to deliver messages to the rest of the staff."
"Damn," whispered Holmes without actually saying the word aloud. He shut off his tiny lantern and tiptoed toward the rear staircase. The servants, almost certainly the head butler and two other male under-butlers, the housekeeper and at least two of her staff, were coming up the main staircase. Obviously, Henry Adams was returning several days early, and his diligent staff was making sure everything would be ready for him in the morning. "Damn," Holmes mouthed again, and slipped up the narrow servant staircase to the rear of the high third floor. With no carpet, the ancient wooden stairs creaked under his weight.
"Hear that?"
one of the under-butlers cried from downstairs.
"If it's a burglar, he's going to get an unwelcome surprise,"
came the head butler's deep voice.
"Shall I send for the police?"
asked the head housekeeper.
"No,"
said the head butler.
"William, Charles, get 2 pokers from the fireplace. Bring one for me. Come with me, William, and we'll check the back rooms and rear staircase."
Most of the third floor was given over to servants' rooms. Holmes had to feel his way in the dark until he found the final staircase, almost steep enough to qualify as a ladder. And as the men stomped and climbed to the second and then third floor below him, calling to one another as they checked rooms, Holmes tiptoed up to the attic. The door to the attic was locked, and it took him precious minutes, working in the near absolute darkness, to use his burglar wires and tools to pick that lock. He stepped into the musty attic. The men had checked all the rooms on the second floor and were converging on the third floor beneath him. Holmes had to risk a light as he shined his lantern in the attic, packed with old steamer trunks, a dressmaker's form rising in front of him like a headless corpse, more suitcases, an empty birdcage. He tiptoed away from the door even as the voices grew louder below him, and someone started climbing the steep stairway to the attic. Holmes had been playing his narrow beam across the steeply sloped ceiling until he found the inevitable trap door to the roof. Luckily, it was directly above 2 tall trunks that he clambered up like a ladder. He put his back into lifting the trap door and hoped that the crashing footfalls below would drown out the slight noise it made as it creaked up on hinges. Then Holmes was outside on the steep and slippery rooftop. The trap door had opened onto the back side of the sloping roof that faced the backyards and the stables. Giving silent thanks for H.H. Richardson's elaborate care with the quality of the building, thick floorboards that had not transmitted his crepe-soled steps, this triple-thick roof with sturdy tiles.
Holmes moved quickly toward the taller pitches and chimneys and gables of John Hay's home. From H Street and the front of the Adams' house, the two grand brick homes looked to be contiguous, but in reality Richardson had separated the east wall of Adams' house from the west wall of the Hayes house by a gap of about 18 inches. Holmes prepared to jump that gap, a narrow black abyss that fell more than 50 feet to the street level, with the full knowledge that the Hayes roof was slightly higher than the Adams' roof he was jumping from. Hearing noises at the trap door far behind him, Holmes shut down his imagination and leaped. He slid back down the steep, gabled surface, slipping toward the sheer drop-off to blackness, but stopped his descent by spread-eagling his body and using his toes and fingers and his body's friction against the tiles. Men were emerging from the trap door in the Adams's roof. Holmes slid 2 feet to his right. The main chimney, handling a dozen outlets to Adams's many fireplaces on the east side of his huge house, was at this east edge of Adams's rooftop, and it was easily 20 feet tall. Holmes kept it between himself and the trap door in order to hide himself from the view of the men emerging onto the Adams's roof as he scrambled up the much steeper roofline of the north-south gable on the Hayes home. He rolled over the ridgeline of that gable and ducked low just as the head butler and his two assistants reached the east end of the Adams's roofline and shined their bright lantern along the empty west slopes of the Hayes gables. Part of the tall, triangular facade that faced H Street and Lafayette Square and the White House hid Holmes from view of anyone out there in the night. When Adams's servants had convinced themselves that no burglar was on their rooftop, they carefully, holding hands at one point, made their way back to and down through the trap door into Adams's attic. Moving on tiptoe again, only occasionally using his fingertips on the terrible steep rooftop, Holmes went up to the ridgeline and then north along it to where the Hayes rooftop gabled up to its highest point, the highest ridgeline almost 70 feet above the sidewalk level. Rather than two massive chimney structures, one west, one east, as on the Adams' house, the Hayes rooftop sprouted six varying brick chimneys. Holmes allowed himself to slide down the steep upper roof until he'd planted his rubber crepe soles against a tall, thin chimney only about a third of the way up on the northwest roofline. He rested there a minute, panting softly, and listened to the lonely clop-clop of a single carriage going down 16th Street. Someone was moving horses into the Adams' stables. Holmes had no idea where they'd been stabled during Henry Adams' weeks of traveling, but here were grooms or stable boys returning them to their stalls at 2 a.m. Various lanterns and at least one glaring electric light illuminated the stable yards, garden, and the entire west rooftop and west side of the chimney behind which Holmes was hiding. He checked his watch and sighed softly. This had not been his first or second plan for egress from the presumably empty Adams's home and return to his own room. But at least he'd made a plan, see? While the grooms got the horses settled below, trying to keep their work as quiet as possible, Holmes removed the thick loop of rope from his burglar bag. It would be embarrassing if he'd not estimated the length of the rope properly. Embarrassing and, from this height, most probably fatal. Eventually, the Adams's horses were back in their stalls, the lanterns extinguished, and even the glow of light onto the backyard from Adams's kitchen had grown dark, although Holmes guessed that the butlers, housekeeper, and the few other servants there so late tonight were in their rooms sleeping. Holmes checked his watch again with the briefest flicker of his hand lantern. Almost 4 a.m. The Hayes domestics would be rising soon to start their interminable days. Holmes tapped the photo secure over his heart, secured the lantern in his burglar bag, and then made sure the bag was clasped shut and its strap secured over his head and shoulder. There were two coils of rope, one short and one long and heavy. Years ago, he'd learned the basic art of rappelling in the Alps. Now he looped the shorter strand of rope around the fireplace,
tied it off securely with double fisherman knots backed up by overhand knots, and ran his longer rope through this anchor sling at midpoint. Running the double rope between his legs, just under his backside, and out to his right hand, in what his first alpine climbing guide had called the Dulfersitz. Firmly holding the doubled line of rope that led to the anchor strap around the chimney in his left hand, and the dangling longer strand of doubled rope that made his uncomfortable Dulfersitz, he carefully let himself down the steep gable to the west edge of the long drop to the Hayes backyard. That morning, the previous morning, he realized now, and again that afternoon, he'd walked to the rear and sides of the Hayes backyard, nominally to smoke his pipe and think, but actually to look up and measure the alignment of this thinnest of the six chimneys directly above his second floor, by American reckoning, room. Now he had to trust to his estimated measurement, even while trusting again that no servant, wandering the halls after midnight, had felt a draft in the hallway and been brazen enough to go into his guest room and shut and latch the window he'd left open. Someday, some repairman on the roof would find his anchor sling, but that was of no concern to Holmes this night. Leaning far back, almost to the horizontal, letting the rappel rope shuffle through his left hand as he wrapped the other length of rope around his right wrist, Holmes walked himself down the side of John Hayes' huge brick home, hopping the 4 feet over the dark window on the third floor that Holmes had ascertained earlier to be an empty servant's bedroom currently being used for storage. Eventually, he was at the second-story window, and he bounced far over the upper glass pane, not wanting to have to explain how his own bedroom window was broken in the night, and, after tapping his crepe soles on the lower windowsill, swung himself far enough into his own room to grab the headboard of the heavy brass bed and steady himself. First, setting the photograph of Irene Adler and Lucan Adler carefully on his bedside table, Holmes went back to the open window and pulled the long length of rappel rope down, taking care that it did not strike a lower window when it dangled. Then he pulled it up, coiled it carefully, and set it back in his black burglar bag. The well-tiered short length of anchor rope would remain up there. The night air was cool, and he left the window open until the sheen of perspiration he'd worked up in all the climbing, jumping, and rappelling dried off. Then Holmes took off his burglar clothes, folding them away neatly, washed himself at the basin, got into his nightclothes, and set his watch to tap its small rod against the open cover at 9 a.m. He and Henry James were leaving for New York City on the 10:42 a.m. train. Holmes had left his palm torch out on the table next to his bed, and before falling asleep, he activated it and played its narrow beam one last time on the photo marked by Henry Adams as Old Sweet Springs, June, 1885, Rebecca Lorne and cousin, standing in meadow with house in background. Staring most intensely at the young man's face, Holmes thought at him, "Why did you kill your mother?" Chapter 22.
So I had stopped by the office of the Sentry on a whim after our ship docked, and was sitting there on their horsehair sofa, reading over some early galleys from our new book, Puddenhead Wilson, said Clemens. And what do I discover but that some pragmatical son of a bitch had been mucking about with my punctuation. My punctuation, gentlemen. The punctuation which I had so carefully thought out and laboriously perfected. I sat there seeing more of this vandalism until my hot fury turned itself loose, and I had a comment for every publisher, editor, secretary, and errand boy in the Century's office. I found as I shouted that the fury had turned itself into a volcano, and the words I was using, well, they were not suited to any Sunday school.
So what happened to the edited copy? Asked Howells.
Clemens lowered his head and peered out from under his bushy eyebrows.
It was explained to me, as one would explain the lower multiplication tables to a drooling idiot, that the culprit proofreader was peerless, imported from no less than Oxford University, and that his word around the century was considered, and I quote, sacred, final, and immutable.
Howells was smiling openly. James showed a hint of a smile and had lowered his chin to his bosom. Holmes sat with his head cocked at a slight angle of polite anticipation.
So did you have a chat with this just-down-from-Oxford don, whose copy edits are sacred, final, and immutable?
Asked Howells, who obviously had played straight man to Clemens many times before this. They were between courses, and Clemens was puffing away at a cigar. His brow was furrowed, his bushy eyebrows almost coming together in his anger, his chin firmly set, and upper body imitating that of a bull ready to charge the toreador. He removed the cigar from beneath a full mustache that was turning white.
I did, said Clemens. I confronted him in the publisher's office, using the poor man as a witness should an actual homicide occur. I was a volcano, and such an angry volcano that not a single poor wretch in the Century's office escaped without being scorched. The publisher and his Oxford proofreader were Pompeii and Herculaneum to my Vesuvius.
What did you say to your punctuation culprit? Henry James asked in soft tones. Clemens shifted his fierce stare to the other writer.
I told both men that I didn't care a fig leaf in hell if the Oxford marvel was an archangel imported directly from heaven. He still could not puke his ignorant impudence over my punctuation. I said I wouldn't allow it for a moment. I said I couldn't stand or sit in the same room in the presence of a single proofreader sheet where that brainless blatherskite had left his chicken-manured tracks. By this time, both Herculaneum and Pompeii had backed up all the way to the windows, and I had a hunch they were ready to throw themselves out those 12-story-high portals. So I literally buttonholed the archangel before he attempted to fly and explained that all this stuff must be set up again and my punctuation restored exactly as I had typed it. Then I promised to return there tomorrow, that is today, precisely at noon, to read the deodorized proof.
Howells was laughing loudly now. James was smiling as broadly as Holmes had ever seen him. Holmes allowed himself a thin smile. When the laughter at the table subsided, nearby diners looking over at the table and then murmuring amongst themselves, obviously the curly-haired author now burying his teeth into the Cuban cigar, Howells said,
"When did you leave Europe, Sam? And from which port?" "From Genoa," said Clemens. "On the steamship Lahn. Got in, as I said, yesterday morning."
"That was a very rapid crossing," said James.
"The captain said he knew of a shortcut," said Clemens, exhaling rich smoke. "And by dander, so he did."
Howells, usually a serious man, Henry James knew, was still laughing and still eager to play the straight man.
"A shortcut across the North Atlantic," laughed Howells. "Can you tell us what secret route your captain of the Lahn took?"
Clemens leaned back in his chair and crossed his arms.
"I fear that I cannot. A small group of perspicacious passengers, with me as their leader, of course, plotted to steal an officer's sextant and thus learn our latitude and longitude."
"Did you carry out your plot?" asked Holmes.
"Indeed we did, sir," answered Clemens. "We simply forgot that none of us knew how to use the device. So after several hours of messing with the clumsy thing, we had succeeded only in pinpointing our precise location either in Central Africa or, equally improbable, Saskatchewan."
Howells was howling now, but Clemens never relinquished his bushy-browed scowl. "There were no clues as to the nature or direction of this transatlantic shortcut?" asked James, allowing himself a quick glance at Holmes when he said the word clues.
"None," said Clemens. None, I should say, save for the time my fellow passengers and I noticed penguins dancing and frolicking in the ice floes that the Lahn was bullying her way through.
Penguins!
Cried Howells, and laughed all the harder. Henry James suddenly understood that the serious and often melancholy author, deadly serious editor, and mature citizen who was William Dean Howells used Samuel Clemens's presence as an excuse to become a boy again.
Naturally, we assumed that the penguins were the ship's waiters and doormen, still in their formal attire, said Clemens, allowed out by the captain for a short period to frolic on the ice.
No!
Cried Howells, with tears running down his cheeks. The loud negative seemed more related to an earnest request that Clemens give him a moment to catch his breath.
Alas, the knowledge of their penguin-tude was too late, Clemens said in a remorseful tone. I had given generous tips to three of them. At least one of them had the decency to hide his face under his upper flipper, or wing, or whatever that thing is called.
Howells continued to laugh. The waiters were bringing their main courses. On the previous day, Tuesday, March 28th, when Holmes had announced to the small group in John Hay's study that the typewriter that had produced the "She Was Murdered" cards over the past 7 years was the same machine that had typed addresses and cards to the Hays from someone named Samuel Clemens, the room had erupted in babble and surprise. It was Hay who explained that Samuel Clemens was the real name for the famous author who wrote under the nom de plume of Mark Twain.
I must interview him at once, Holmes had said. Either Hay or James shall accompany me.
I fear that will not be possible, said Henry James. I've read over the past few years in the London papers that Mr. Twain, Mr. Clemens, has been en famille, on an extensive tour of Europe, Germany, Switzerland, Italy, since 1891, I believe. Something to do with debts, persistent American creditors, and the strength of the dollar on the continent. The last I read, Clemens and his family had moved on from Florence and to Bad Nauheim, with Mr. Clemens occasionally taking the baths for his rheumatism.
Holmes looked crestfallen until John Hay said brightly,
Actually, we're in luck. I received a letter from Sam, from Mr. Clemens, only 2 weeks ago, in which he said he'd be sailing from Italy on the 22nd of this month, bound for New York, to carry out several business meetings. I believe he was eventually going to Chicago to meet with someone there and to get a preview of the Columbia Exposition before returning to Europe 6 weeks from now.
He'll be in New York? Holmes asked.
He should be there, or on the point of arriving there, even as we speak, said Hay.
We must leave at once, said the detective.
Clara Hay gave her husband a sharp glance, and Hay held up his hands.
Alas, I'm too busy this week, socially and otherwise, to take time out for a trip to New York. But I'm sure Harry would enjoy accompanying you. I don't believe that he and Clemens have met yet. And Harry... Sam wrote me that he planned to dine with Howells as soon after he reached New York as he could. Perhaps you could join them.
Who is Howells?
Asked Sherlock Holmes.
William Dean Howells, said Hay. He's an old friend of Harry's as well as of Sam's, an author of some renown in his own right, but also a well-known critic. Howells was fiction editor of the Atlantic Monthly from 71 to 81. Helping not only to publish friends such as Harry and Sam, but to promote them, and wrote a column for Harper's Weekly until 82.
Good, said Holmes. James can introduce me when the three old literary colleagues are chatting, and we can ease our way into the Clover Adams business. If you shall be so kind as to cable Howells of our arrival, we shall leave today for New York.
But, said James, but could come up with no reason for his not going, other than his not wanting to do so.
Clemens might well have taken the typewriter to Europe with him, said Hay.
Not important, Holmes had said. The important thing is for Clemens to tell us who had access to his typewriter between December 6th, 1885, and December 6th,
1886.
But that, began Clara Hay, and then stopped. I see. If the cards were all typed at the same time, you think it must have been between Clover's death and the first anniversary of her death, the first time we all received the typewritten cards.
Surely you're not considering Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, as a suspect, said John Hay.
Only his typewriter, replied Holmes. And before we go any further, we must know who had access to it after Clover Adams's death.
Someone could have typed those cards before her death, said Clara Hay. Holmes had smiled thinly at his hostess.
Perhaps, but that person would also have been her murderer. All the more reason to speak to this Twain-Clemens person as soon as possible.
Turning to Henry James, Holmes cried,
Quick, James, pack some things in your Gladstone bag and let's be off. The game is afoot.
What brings you to the States, Sam?
Howells was asking.
Business, growled the man between bites of his prime rib.
All business. Money, debt, and business. Business, debt, and money. Last night I had dinner with Andrew Carnegie.
James, who paid little attention to millionaires or their comings and goings, was still impressed.
How did that dinner go? Asked Howells.
Just dandy, said Clemens. Carnegie wanted to talk to me about yachting, about the price of gold, about the British royal family, about libraries, about my family's experience living in Europe the past few years, about Swiss tutors, and especially, at great length, I might say, about his harebrained scheme for the United States to absorb Canada, Ireland, and all of Great Britain into a single American Commonwealth. I, on the other hand, wanted to talk about him lending me some money, or I should say, investing some capital in marvelous and foolproof ventures.
I trust your conversations were productive, said James.
Clemens's brows came down.
I explained to Carnegie my little investments in kaolatype, in various other sure-to-be-hits inventions and games, in my publishing house, and especially in Mr. Page's typesetting machine, which by itself, to date, for only the Page typesetter investment, I have poured something like $190,000 into, without ever seeing the goddamn... without seeing the blasted thing work properly for more than 2 minutes at a time.
What did Mr. Carnegie say to these investment possibilities? Asked Howells.
He leaned forward and whispered to me his secret of getting and staying rich,
Clemens said in a low, conspiratorial tone of voice. The three other men at the table, even Holmes, also leaned forward conspiratorially to hear the secret from no less an expert than Andrew Carnegie.
Carnegie said, whispered Clemens, and I quote him exactly, "My boy, put all your eggs in one basket, and watch that basket."
While Howells and James laughed and Holmes allowed himself a smile, Sam Clemens continued to scowl.
He was serious,
Clemens growled into the laughter.
Perhaps the Page typesetter is your basket, said Howells.
Clemens grunted.
If it is, it's a basket without a bottom or handles. Why don't you just, how do you Americans put it, cut your losses and get out? Asked Holmes. I've invested too much, growled Clemens. As a businessman, I give the word fool a bad name. Livy says so. My muscular Christian minister friend Joe Twitchell says so. All my friends who are not earlobe deep in debt say so. But I still hope this Page machine will be the avenue to my own fortune and to my family's security. The thing not only sets type brilliantly, you see, it automatically justifies, something that no typesetting device on the planet can do. The good news is that 40 or 50 of Page's miracle typesetters are in the process of being produced, and the Chicago Tribune is going to give one a trial by fire.
Before this trip is over, I plan to make the 800-mile trip to Chicago to talk to Paige. My goal was to dissolve our partnership during that conversation.
But James Paige can be very convincing in person, suggested Howells.
Convincing?
Cried Clemens loud enough that a few other diners looked toward his table.
Why, every time I arrange it so that Paige's doomsday moment is nigh, the termination of my investment irrevocable and my lawsuits against the man shatteringly inevitable, the inventor pitches another bravura performance that would put Edwin Booth to shame. Tears, earnest promises, heartfelt assurances, injured dignity. A list of facts and figures that would put a certified accountant into a coma, and all while showing a woeful, profoundly hurt expression that would put a basset hound with hemorrhoids to shame. Why, James Paige could persuade a fish to come out and take a walk with him. No matter how much resolve and determination I stockpile ahead of time for the encounter, whenever I am with Paige, I believe him. I can't help it. Livy says that the man is a mesmerist, not an inventor. I say that he is one of the most daring.